Those who were able to join us yesterday have already met Professor Stephen Bevans. For those who are just joining us today, you're in for a real treat. Professor Bevans is an internationally famous missiologist, and one of his key contributions, I think, is that he's able to present in a way that makes sense to ordinary folk. You don't have to be an academic missiologist to understand what he's saying. So I'll invite Professor Stephen Bevans to give his second speech for our conference. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sandy. Good morning, everyone. It's good to be back here. I hope you noticed that I spelled mission correct. That's and you might notice as well that I've just slightly changed the title from what is in your program. My title is Doing Mission Today, Where We Do It, How We Do It, What We Do. I've added the where we do it because I think it's important that we understand that we do mission in a particular context, in a particular place. And the organizers of the conference asked me to talk in the second talk about doing mission, particularly in kind of secularized cultures like my own United States and Australia. And so that's what I'm going to try to do in this presentation. But just a brief introduction and kind of like going back to what we did yesterday, what I talked about yesterday. We tried to engage our theological imaginations in reimagining mission in a fresh way. Seeing mission as, first of all, of course, God's mission or God's practice, which was going on from the first nanosecond of creation. That the first act of God's mission is creation. And that God was present through the Spirit, who, to just acknowledge Patrick's comments yesterday, who was sowing the seeds of the Word that was fulfilled or sprouted, you might say, in the body and the history of Jesus. And then, amazingly, after Jesus' resurrection, the Spirit who anointed Jesus for mission anoints us for mission. And so our mission is the same mission as that mission of Jesus, the same mission of the Spirit present from the very beginning of creation, leading creation to a new creation. So we do mission. This is kind of my idea here. We do mission not just because we're commanded. Yes, Jesus says, you know, go to all the world and preach the good news in Mark's gospel, in Matthew's gospel, go forth, make all nations my disciples and so forth. We're commanded, but I think much more interestingly and much more exciting is the fact that mission is a result of God's grace. To do mission is to participate in God's life. And in baptism, we were plunged into God's life, plunged into the life of the Trinity. And so in mission, we're only doing what we have been given through grace in baptism. Now, in this second talk, as I said, my task is to reflect somewhat on the practical implications of what this all means. This is very dangerous for me because I'm a theologian. I'm a missiologist. I'm not a practical theologian or anything. So it's a little bit dangerous, but I hope that there will be certainly practical implications from what I've talked about. After all, I do mission. After all, I'm engaged in mission in my life. But as I say, particularly in these more secularized cultures like yours here in Australia and mine in the United States. Of course, when I say I'm going to say something about Australia, that's very bold of me to do. So you have to pardon any stupid mistakes I say or stupid mistakes I make. But in any case, that's what the organizers brought me all the way from Chicago for. So I'll at least try to do a little bit of that. But I'm going to do this in three parts. Where we do mission. So the focus on U.S. and Australia, and that's why there are those question marks there. I dare to do this. It's very, very bold of me to do this. Luckily, I have had some help in a wonderful paper that Noel Connolly wrote and gave last week in Rome. And so I'm going to use his ideas an awful lot, very unabashedly steal from him in this presentation. And then secondly, I'm going to look at how we do mission, suggesting that the way we do mission is in a spirituality of what my colleague Roger Schrader and I have called prophetic dialogue. And then finally, what we might do. And I'm going to focus on looking at the six elements or practices of mission that Roger Schrader and I point out in our book, Conscience and Context, toward the end. And also, there's a little chapter in Prophetic Dialogue, the picture that is up there of our 2011 book. And we talk about these six elements or practices there. So, first of all, where we do mission. I want to start out by recalling the great mission encyclical of John Paul II. Redemptoris Missio. In paragraph 33 of that encyclical, John Paul says that mission is carried out in three kinds of contexts or three kinds of situation. The first one, and that was kind of the focus of the encyclical Redemptoris Missio, is the mission ad gentes. So to preach the gospel where it is not yet known, not yet fully received, and or still weak, where the church community is still weak. Secondly, there's the action of pastoral care, done in communities who are solid in their faith and forming those communities to make a difference in the world, to participate in mission beyond the boundaries of the parish, beyond the boundaries of the church. And then thirdly, he talks about the new evangelization. In those situations, those places where people don't practice their faith anymore, where they've lost their faith, where they've been disillusioned by the church or in their faith. And John Paul II says that, you know, these are not three absolutely discrete, watertight compartments of the way we do mission. They're really very porous. They're very fixed. And they really work with one another. And I think all three are needed in our context of a place like the U.S. or the place like here in Australia. Mission in both of our contexts is complexified or complicated by this dazzling diversity of nationalities and cultures that are present in both our countries. And often because, as Gemma pointed out so eloquently and beautifully, because of migration. And there's so much work there, I think, in many ways, of pastoral care, but also because migrations also bring non-Christians, there is the task of evangelizing these people who have come to our shores and sharing with them the good news of Christ. And so this is the mission ad gentes, or as we missiologists prefer now, inter gentes, among the people, as Gemma pointed out, mission among migrants. Also, today in our culture's mission is faced with a culture that's highly secularized, individualized, addicted to consumerism, to accumulating goods, influenced, this is particularly true, I think, in my country, by these narcissistic athletes and entertainers by what American University of Notre Dame sociologist Christian Smith calls a kind of a therapeutic deism, particularly among young adults. In other words, that religion is something to help me feel good, not something to transform me and challenge me and move me out to service. And here I think, you know, we're faced with the idea of the new evangelization. And also, as we know so well, many Catholics are alienated from the church because of this horrific sexual abuse crisis that was bad enough that clergy abused youth. But then when the hierarchy of the church tries to conceal that and cover up that, and this comes out, the incredible scandal that that caused. And because of the constant not paying attention to the role of women in the church, as many people say, the church in our countries are hemorrhaging women. Women are leaving in large numbers, disenchanted by what's going on in the church. Or the inability sometimes of the church to listen to questions that people are asking, struggling with questions like abortion or divorce or homosexuality or reproductive issues, those kinds of things. In my own country, people are frustrated because our bishops are meddling in politics, basically telling us that if we vote for a certain person or a certain policy, we shouldn't go to communion. And people say, you know, they have no right to say that. Or, you know, in the last couple of years, in a kind of a high-handed way, a new translation of the liturgy has been kind of imposed on us. Very clunky and in some ways ugly in its literal and sometimes I think not so literal translations of the original Latin. In the U.S., I read in the National Catholic Reporter the other day, former Catholics are the third largest denomination of Christians. Used to be second. I thought it was second, but the National Catholic Reporter says now it's the third largest. I don't know if that's true in Australia, but I would imagine it's relatively similar. And the fastest growing group in the United States and in, I think, Australia as well are these groups that, these people that sociologists are calling the nuns, N-O-N-E-S. Those who are not affiliated with any religion at all. So it seems that in our cultures, all the problems of Western globalized society are here really in spades. But the other side of this, and I think this is important if we're thinking about evangelization, and particularly the new evangelization, is to see the amazing vitality that is present in our people as well. Both Americans and Australians are deep believers in democracy and in participation. I've been reading in these days, kind of at the recommendation of Noel, John Thornhill's book, Making Australia. And there's one chapter in there where he says, everyone must have a fair start. So that kind of idea. Now, their democracy is in our bones. And because of that, people want to have a say in the church and in the governance of the church. And we are probably some of the best educated people on earth. And so we can't be talked down to by church authorities. We will not stand for authoritarianism. Nevertheless, we're extremely generous people. In my own country, after Hurricane Katrina a number of years ago, back I believe in 2005, and Sandy, Hurricane Sandy last October, The last time I was here in Australia was 2009. I arrived on February 3rd, just before, what's it called, Black Saturday, when these horrible fires in Victoria and so many people lost their lives. And the generosity of Australians and the religiosity of Australians, you know, certainly just came to the fore in all of that. So I think, you know, we do have a great need in our societies today for a new evangelization. But we have to remember it's a missionary task. And that every missionary needs to go into a place, and in the famous words of Max Warren, take off his shoes or her shoes, knowing that the land you are going to is holy. Because God has been there before our arrival. Vatican II's document on mission, I mentioned it yesterday, talks about that secret presence of God in every culture, in every land, in every time. And we really have to acknowledge that if we're going to do mission, if we're going to do new evangelization in our cultures. Certainly there's a lot to challenge, but I think there's a lot to tap into as well. You know, the United States, my country, is understood as among the most religious nations on earth. A friend of mine, who was not an American, said the most religious country he ever went to was India. He said it just breathed of spirituality. He said the second most religious country he was ever in was the United States. Really interesting. The picture here is a new book, 2012, something like that, by a man named Frank Newport, who is on the staff of the famous Gallup poll, you know, surveys. And as you see, the book is called God is Alive and Well, The Future of Religion in America. And his basic thesis is this, that although Americans tend to shy away from organized religion, you know, I'm spiritual, I'm not religious, you know, that line, nevertheless, it doesn't mean they're abandoning religiosity as such. His basic thesis, again, is this, that Americans have potential religious energy locked up, ready to be converted to activated energy if and when the time is right. And he says this sets the stage for future religious developments. Noel Connolly, in his paper that I referred to in the beginning of my presentation, says this, Australia is a postmodern, secular, and multicultural country. But secular does not mean irreligious, anti-religious, or lacking in spirituality. Religion and spirituality are growing, but the churches have lost their monopoly. Noel says that, contrary to what a lot of people think, Australia is not the most secularized country in the world. While Australians have great reluctance to talk about religion publicly, and John Thornhill's book that I've been reading, and Noel pointed it out to me, the last chapter is on religion, and it's called The Embarrassing Subject for Australians. Nevertheless, Thornhill says, as Manning Clark has said, that there's in Australians a whisper in the mind and a shy hope in the heart. And many Australians are searching for the transcendent. And what Thornhill says is that we need to tell the Jesus story in ways that are more attractive, less dogmatic, less doctrinal, less heady, and much more involving people in that incredible, wonderful story, which hopefully I told yesterday in a way that engages us in that regard. And so from this perspective, my sense is, as a theologian and a missiologist, that with the proper spirituality and the proper methods of evangelization, by a church on the one hand, deeply faithful to the spirit and the message of the gospel, and on the other hand, faithful to the signs of the times, to what's going on, where the spirit is in contemporary culture, that we have a chance of achieving a modest success. We're not going to have Christendom again. We're in a post-Christendom world. That's not going to happen. But I think with humility, with spirituality, and with real efforts at trying to read those signs of the times, we can have a modest success in sharing the good news with our countrymen and countrywomen. The challenge, as New Zealand theologian Susan Smith says, and I like that image, is to tap into the transcendence that people are feeling all the time. Or as, again, I read this in Thornhill the other day and loved it, he quotes the Australian poet, novelist, Les Murray, who says that Australians carry within them a kind of inner poem that we carry within. You know, that the new evangelization, I think, is about tapping into that, is about naming that, is about calling that forth. And so this is why the how of mission today and the what of mission today is really important. The spirituality and, if you will, the methods. So let's look at our second point. How do we do mission? I'm not giving you here an instruction manual. You know, I'm not giving you a program. Well, you first do this. You gather people and you ask these questions and you come up with these answers and then you form this group or anything like that. You can't do that, I don't think, in any kind of mission that really is worth its salt. Because mission is only done in day-to-day reflection and prayer on what is going on in one's community, in one's world. It's only done after broad community discussion and discernment. I think what I'm saying about how is that it's an attitude that we have to bring, or even a spirituality that we have to bring to our missionary work. And that's what I want to talk about here. Roger Schrader and I have called this, borrowing from the SVD 2000 general chapter, calling this a spirituality of prophetic dialogue. Now, I'm going to focus in my presentation here on the dialogue aspect, and even though both are equally important, and I don't want to denigrate at all the prophetic aspect, but my narrower focus here is just because I don't have time. When I first began to write this presentation, I just started writing and writing and writing, and I was having, you know, 17, 18, 19 single-spaced pages, and I said, I have to cut this down. So I cut all the prophetic stuff out. I'll mention it a little bit. I also think that the whole attitude or spirituality of dialogue that we bring to our mission today is what is most relevant for our U.S. and Australian context. Basically what this is that we need to cultivate a fundamental stance of openness to people, to cultures, to contexts as we do mission. Respect, reverence, relationship, friendships, a deep listening, and even a vulnerability. And this is not arbitrary. This is not a strategy so we can get people in. We participate in the work of the triune God. Mission is Trinitarian practice. And God is a God of dialogue. The way God does mission is God, to quote John Owen again, never forces the divine mystery upon us. And so if the triune God carries out the divine mission in dialogue and for dialogue, so must we, women and men who are baptized in the Trinity's name, do mission as partners of the Trinity in partnership with God. What does it mean to have mission in dialogue? One of the most wonderful phrases that I've come across for this is from the African-American poet and novelist Alice Walker. And she says in an essay that she writes, she says, you know, we have to have a heart so open that the wind blows through it. One of my great colleagues at CTU, Claude Marie Barbour, missionary in South Africa, tortured by the government in South Africa, has taught at CTU, taking people to Native American reservations and exposing them to the culture there and so forth. She talks about the fact if we're going to do mission, we have to participate first in mission in reverse. And what that means is, she says, that we have to be evangelized first by the people whom we dare to evangelize. That we have to allow the people to whom we go, among whom we live, to be our teachers first. And then when we understand, when we get an inkling of that secret presence of God, then we can dare share our message with them. I think that really captures this basic idea of mission and dialogue. So the first step in mission is this deep listening, this docility. Docility from docere in Latin, you know, to teach, to be teachable, to live in gentleness, to have the ability to forge relationships. Again, Noel Connolly. Most people listen more willingly to people who appreciate them and are learning along with them. I think very wise words from a veteran missionary and scholar. At the 1910 Edinburgh Conference, which a lot of people say is the beginning of the ecumenical movement, it was a big meeting of basically Protestants in 1910. The most famous speech that was given was given by an Indian Anglican clergyman by the name of A.S. Azariah. And Azariah got up and he was talking about his relationship with missionaries and how he felt as an Indian person so persecuted and so denigrated by the way they treated him. He said things like, he said, you know, you promise us thrones in heaven, but we're not able to sit in chairs in your drawing rooms. And he ended, his last line was, give us friends. You know, again, that's, I think, what mission in dialogue is all about. Forging relationships, becoming friends with people, with cultures. Again, I told you I'm taking a lot from Noel in his presentation. He says, we are most missionary when we move out to discover what God is doing around us. Then we will be a more authentic and convincing sign of God's hopes for the world. Noel quotes an editorial in the National Catholic Reporter during the Synod of Bishops. And it's talking about the fact that these rising groups of nuns are not particularly interested in our ready-made answers. And it goes on to say, is it possible that nuns can teach us something about God? Or at least we can learn something from listening to their questions? The church's challenge is not to supply answers, but to accompany people on their spiritual quests. Sometimes I think, you know, the way we hear the new evangelization, and pardon me if this is too much of a caricature, but it's almost like we're saying the same old thing, we're just saying it louder. You know, I just don't think that really cuts it. That's, I don't think, the way, the new methods and the new ardor, and so forth that John Paul II talked about in terms of the new evangelization. It's not just by saying things louder. It's by changing our whole approach, being more hospitable, me being more open, being more listening. In February 2003, there appeared an article by a woman named Annie Salak, in a blog on the Washington Post. As far as I know, I think she's a rector of a dormitory at the University of Notre Dame in the United States in South Bend, Indiana. And it was entitled, What Do Young Catholics Want? And she gives four answers. I won't go into the details here, but they all revolved around openness and dialogue. That's what young people want from the church. And I think it's not only young Catholics that want this. I think it's many, many other Catholics that want this. And she says, we want the church to ask the questions we are asking. You know, to grapple with the questions that we are grappling with. And what are those questions? Women's equality and participation in the world and in the church. Sexuality, including homosexuality, same-sex marriage, truth that exists outside the pale of Christianity. And she says, you know, there's an urgency to these issues because they're not just nameless people on the margins that we're talking about here, but these are our friends, our family members, our mentors, and our leaders. And she went on to say, you know, that we grew up in this multicultural society with people who were not Christians. And we find them, some of the holiest people we know. In reading last week in the National Catholic Reporter, I came across an article talking about a famous talk that this man, Martin Verlin, had given. He's the abbot of Einsiedeln, this very famous monastery in Switzerland. And he says this, you know, not taking a situation seriously is an act of disobedience. Disobedience lamented by office holders often results from the disobedience of those in office. It's a very interesting statement about the importance of listening. And that reminds me of, I think, my favorite intervention in the 2012 Synod on the New Evangelization by Cardinal Luis Antonio Tagle, who's the Archbishop of Manila. He said that, you know, perhaps rather than always speaking, the church needs to keep silent and listen. He said the church must discover the power of silence. Confronted with the sorrows, doubts, and uncertainties of people, she cannot pretend to give easy solutions. Imagine if we had such an open church. Such a learning church, such a vulnerable church. What a witness, I think, we could be of the vulnerable God who revealed God's self most fully on the cross. What a witness we could be if we really did mission in dialogue. And it's within and only within dialogue that I think we can talk about prophecy. You know, proclaiming hope, the message of the gospel, witnessing to the gospel's transforming truth, confronting injustice. Dialogue is the condition for the possibility of prophecy. Archbishop Bernard Longley, the Archbishop of Birmingham in England, said that, again, the first step in proclaiming the gospel has to be a profound listening. He says, there can be no effective proclamation of the faith without an attempt to understand how the message is likely to be heard, how it sounds to others. Let's move to our third point, and that is what we do in mission. Now here, I just want to rely on the six elements or practices that my colleague Roger Schrader and I propose at the end of the book, Constants in Context. And these six elements or practices are these: witness and proclamation, liturgy, prayer, and contemplation, justice, peace, and the integrity of creation, interreligious and secular dialogue, inculturation and reconciliation. And I'm going to look at not all of these again. You know, this thing got longer and longer as I went along. And I'm not going to do it so much systematically, but I am going to try, I think, to hit in some way all of these 6 points if I still have time. 1 minute? Oh, my heavens. Well, I have to skip this then, and I have to go to my conclusion. I think that doing mission today in our context is one that is really more of a spirituality than a strategy. And this is an idea that my colleague Robert Schrider uses when he talks about working in terms of reconciliation. How we do mission ultimately is more important than what we do. As is attributed to Mother Teresa, we're not asked to be successful, but we are asked to be faithful. Ultimately, I think we need to assume a vulnerability in mission, not unlike God's Word, who emptied God's self to become one of us, not unlike Mary, whose sinlessness made her totally available for God's work. There's a powerful article that a friend of mine in Italy sent me, written by the great Italian theologian Severino Dianich during the Sede Vacante period, you know, after Pope Benedict resigned. And he quotes Benedict in a talk that he gave about a year ago, saying that only when the church is freed from the material trappings and privileges of the past can it show a face that reveals the gospel to the world. Pope Francis, I think, and overlapping here what Maureen said yesterday, that I think he gives a positive aspect of this in his inaugural homily. Caring, protecting, demands goodness. It calls for a certain tenderness. In the Gospels, Saint Joseph appears as a strong and courageous man, a working man. Yet in his heart, we see great tenderness. He wrote this, of course, he gave this on March 19th, the Feast of Saint Joseph. We see in his heart a great tenderness, which is not the virtue of the weak, but rather a sign of strength of spirit and capacity for concern, for compassion, for genuine openness to others, for love. We must not be afraid of goodness, of tenderness. Tenderness. I think that word expresses it all. And given the lack of credibility of the church for many today, and given the meanness of some actions that people in the church have taken in our day, and given the hope that the new evangelization holds, I think a tender church would be wonderful good news indeed. Thank you very much.
One of my least favourite things about facilitating is winding people up when they're giving such an interesting talk, but we will have more time to speak with Stephen shortly. Yesterday he set foundations for us, helping us to think about what mission is. Today he's taken us into what do we do, how do we do it, the very questions that were arising for us yesterday, because Australians are pretty pragmatic people. We like to do something about it rather than just think about it, talk about it. So that's really very helpful, and we'll hear a bit more. Mr. Graham Mundine is going to help us to begin to unpack this for our own context, really grounded in our own soil and water here. Graham is a Bundjalung man, and he's the executive officer of the Aboriginal Catholic Ministry in the Archdiocese of Sydney. He's been a really important person in the life of the Catholic Church in Australia. He was the inaugural chair and coordinator of the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Catholic Council. And he also worked as executive officer of the National Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Ecumenical Commission, which is a commission of the National Council of Churches in Australia. Here he is, live and deadly.
That's good. I myself don't like replying to someone else's speech because it's... I think we hear a great message already. You don't need me to come along and to muck it up for you. But a couple of things I'd like to... Of course, when I was first asked, I was very honoured that to reply to Stephen. The last time I met Stephen was at the World Mission Conference in Edinburgh in 2010. And I was interested with his little quote about the Indian speaking because I'm afraid... In the 2010 conference, it was very much the same, that Indigenous peoples, those who were being missioned to, their voices weren't being heard much. I'd like to start by... Oh, a couple of things from this morning. First thing is that if Australia was colonised, settled, and there was no war between Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples... I think that you all have a big problem because all of you would be illegal immigrants. And thank God for your sake that we didn't have an offshore immigration policy. I think in the area of mission, sometimes when we're dealing with Indigenous peoples, in my particular case, sometimes I sense in the area of mission a sense of pity towards us at times. And I think that we at times need to stop and to think about the way that we relate to those we're missioning to. We're not just a social justice issue. We're human beings. And to be able to say that, I'd like to tell you a story. One that you know, and I apologise for all those who've heard me talk over many years using the same stories, but one that you know and you know so well. And it goes something like this. In the beginning, there was darkness. Then God said, let there be light, and there was. Let there be land, and let there be water. Let there be birds of the air, fishes of the sea, and there was. And then eventually God reached down and grabbed some dirt, blew life into it, and humankind was formed. If that's not an Aboriginal dreaming story, I don't know what is. It talks about the beginning of the world and how we come to be here. But for us as people, I think the story goes on and tells us a lot more. It talks about you and I, that God created you. And if God created you, each and every single one of you are very, 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 very special people. You are unique. You are magnificent. You are tremendous. You are fantastic because God created you. And likewise, God created me. And I'm a very, 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 very special person. Also unique, magnificent, tremendous, fantastic, because God created me. And because God created you, I owe you the respect that's due to each and every single one of you because you are part of God's creation. And likewise, you owe me the respect that's due to me because of my being part of God's creation. The story goes on and also talks about our relationship with the sky, the trees, the birds, who are also parts of God's creation. Brother kangaroo, sister emu, Aardie tree, stars in the sky, cousins. This is our relationship. And I think it's very important when we're dealing in mission with people, whether they be Indigenous peoples or whether they be those who've come across the sea, that we do remember that they are people, that they are part of God's creation, and we owe them so much respect and love because of that. I'll tell you another story about the role that I play, and I hold these two stories, well, there are three, but two for starters, of being very important in my work and mission. The first one is a story about a guy called Lazarus. Jesus is out preaching one day, and of course word comes down that his mate Lazarus has passed away. And he says, look, just hang on a minute, I'll just finish off what I'm doing. And then off he goes. But by the time he gets to the place where Lazarus lived, not only was Lazarus dead, he'd be dead for 3 days and been buried. And of course the story tells us that Jesus is brought to tears as he goes to the tomb. And he says to those around him, roll back that stone. When they come staggering up, they roll back the stone. And he peers down into the middle of that tomb, that cave. And he says, come forth. And Lazarus staggers out of that cave, all bound up in his burial clothes. And then he says something that's quite remarkable. Unbind him and let him go free. That's my mission. It is the mission that I've been involved with for the last 30 years. Firstly, is that for a lot of Indigenous people, we are normally by mainstream society locked up and buried, even to the point of view we roll a stone over them so we don't want to see what's happening in our Aboriginal communities today. But what does Jesus want? Firstly, he says, well, let's roll back that stone. Let's peer in to see what's happening here in this experience for Aboriginal people. And like at the beginning of time, he calls us forth. And Aboriginal people come staggering out of that tomb, all bound up of the things of colonisation and Western world. Dispossession of land. Murder, in a lot of cases, being downtrodden by mainstream society. But what does Jesus say to each and every one of us around them? Unbind them and let them go free. Let's break these things that tie people up so that they can fully live the life that was given to them at the beginning of time. That they are part of God's creation and that they are very, 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 very special people. The other story, of course, is the story about Zacchaeus. Jesus is walking along the road and there's this little short little runt like myself standing on the side of the road who wants to see what's going on. And of course he can't see because of the crowds. So he climbs up the tree and he peers down at Jesus and Jesus comes past and as he does he stops and he peers up at Jesus, at Zacchaeus, not Jesus, Jesus down on the ground. And he says to Zacchaeus, come down here. And Zacchaeus does, climbs down out of the tree to meet with Jesus. And then Jesus, let's go off and share a meal together. And that's my mission to you. I got one of those on notes too. And that's my mission to you. As Aboriginal people travel around sometimes non-Indigenous people like to get up in that tree. In some cases, they speak a whole different language than the rest of us, even though you've educated us so much about your English language. But sometimes it's important to get out of that tree, as Stephen was just talking about, to come down and be with us and with us, so that we can go off together and to share that meal together as a group. Thank you.